All right. Well, welcome to our special edition of Game Chat, where we are talking with the developer of Trackless 12, 12 East Games and Aubrey Sayre. Okay, excellent. Well, welcome, Aubrey. We are so glad to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely no problem. So you're pretty much the one man show on Trackless, right? Designer, CEO, programmer, artist.
I work with my wife Angelica. She's also
Okay,
here.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Angelica.
Hello.
Welcome.
She handles most of the business stuff so that I'm more free just to focus
Yeah.
on the actual, game, the self-contained game.
Yeah, absolutely. And then Trackless is the first game you've done with 12 East, under 12 East Games, right?
Correct.
Okay, excellent. You worked with other projects before that.
Yeah, I think I lost track at some point. I did something like 15 games, I think.
Yeah, awesome.
So, but mostly as an artist, and
Okay.
usually just as a like a contributing contract artist. So pretty
Yeah.
low billing.
Yeah. Yeah, the artwork is, I know in Trackless, it's really good. I was just looking at other things. For those listening, if you go to 12eastgames.com, you can check out their stuff. But I really enjoy your art. You're pretty
Thanks.
good at it. You're pretty good at
Yeah,
it.
I tried to pick an art style that was going
Yeah.
to be, something I could definitely execute on. Like,
Yeah.
was pretty well within my comfort zone.
Yeah,
So,
for sure. How long did you work on Trackless?
all told, kind of the game in its current form kind of came together over about the course of a year.
Okay.
But even that, like the very first version of the game was sort of a more of a missed homage, and it had a totally different art style and different gameplay. But some of the same, like the same core idea that you would put a verb in to interact with the environment. But I did this for a jam project, and it
Oh
was a
yeah.
week-long jam, and I spent almost all of the time on art. And then when I showed people the project, nobody mentioned the art. So yeah, so I changed it.
Yeah. So, but the story, the kind of like the idea of the game was there with the art still?
Yeah, the core idea that you would put in a verb, kind of the simplified version of like a text parser, was there. But it only had one puzzle. It was just a door, and you would have to type open.
Which is going off of, I'm guessing, I mean, that's probably kind of the type of games maybe you did you grow up with those types of games where you had to type in actions and type in what you had to do?
Yeah,
Yeah,
absolutely. And
yeah,
if
yeah.
you've played any of those games, like kind of the first thing that's really like evident about them is how frustrating they are.
Yes, they
Yeah.
are.
Yeah. It's yeah, because you have to type in exactly what it wants you to type in. And some of those games didn't, if I remember correctly, didn't have that many alternatives. Like you had to type in what it wanted you to. Whereas in Trackless, like you do have different alternatives that give you different points.
So yeah, if you're totally unacquainted with that kind of game, you don't even know what kind of grammar it is expecting, right? And so it's not just one word, it's like some kind of sentence pick up whatever, scroll. And you're like, wow,
Yeah, for sure. Where was there any specific place that the idea for Trackless's story and world came from?
I at the time I was living in San Francisco, and this was sort of before the Trump election, and then and sort of just like people in San Francisco, there's a lot of very like well-off people, and their problems get kind of smaller and smaller the more money you have. I noticed, I'm poor now, and I was because of Trackless, thanks. But I was you know, I was poor before I moved to San Francisco.
Yeah.
I worked on a pretty well-known game that did okay, Overgrowth. So mm-hmm. for a while I was doing okay, and, mm-hmm. and I was in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed a lot of these people, the more money they had, the smaller their problems got until, mm-hmm. and I was like, well, what happens when your problems become so small that they like disappear when nobody has any problems and everything is sort of solved. And so the idea for Trackless's World was what would like kind of my utopia look like, right? Like people say that every person's utopia is somebody else's dystopia, but I was like, this is as good as I could imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Trackless is also inspired by places in Portland. So if you visit Portland, you'll notice that there is a tree where you can write little notes about your wishes.
Yeah.
And also the bridges are amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a lot of places in the game that are directly inspired by real life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely another source of inspiration.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I saw that on your website. You actually have a video or a little slideshow of the pictures of the actual places that they're inspired from.
Yeah.
Different pieces of the game. So did you find that, so it kind of played hand in hand of, you know, you had this original idea, but then also seeing these places kind of inspired you to kind of to create the different areas in the game?
Yeah, for me, it's very important that the game reflects reality in some way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Like, there's a lot of games, like, you know, there's a lot of games out there that are purely escapist, but, and I don't know, I think that those games are sort of lying to players, if I'm being honest. That's what I think they're doing, and I wanted to make a game that I felt was honest. Like, mm-hmm. like it's still fantastical, but I think that it's telling the truth.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. Because we were talking about that before, was that, you know, there are definitely moments in the game that kind of made you kind of stop and think, little nuggets of truth, like I was mentioning to them, and it was just really small. But when you find the VR room with the people hooked up to the VR machines, and there is a chair that's open with the VR set, and you click on it, and it says something like, this VR set is ready to use, but if you use this VR, you know, if we get caught up in the VR system or something like that, that you'll lose sight of your mission to find the source,
right,
in so many words. And it was just one sentence, but it just clicked with me. I was like, oh my gosh, like that's very true to life, in that you can get caught up in all these other frivolous things and just lose sight of your one goal and lose sight of what you want to do in life.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that those were definitely things that were scattered throughout. So you definitely did a good job with that.
Thanks.
Yeah, for sure. So I also noticed that, like, towards and going along with that, like, I personally noticed was there anything that in particular inspired you for this story of going through the trials and to eventually get to the source? With the confessional and stuff, it almost seemed kind of religious in a way.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of the actual locations, like all three of the trials are sort of inspired by real places. And so, like, the mm-hmm. first one's inspired by, like, the Vatican, actually, right? And so you have, like, you know. So it's sort of, like, shaped like a church, and you do some church-type stuff. But one of the, like, and that's a theme in a bunch of the stuff that I've done. I don't know why I'm not, like, a religious person. But, like, Trackless is also sort of, a previous game I made, Receiver, also has a really weird sort of religious, pseudo-religious story. But one of the things that I was noticing as I tried to come up with puzzle ideas is that it's actually, like, for when you think about verbs, there's a ton of verbs that everybody knows that are related to religion.
Right.
So it made it really easy to actually make the puzzles, And it also makes sense, you know, you're like on a pilgrimage. There has to be like some point to a journey, but like, I was inspired by going on actual adventures. So it's an adventure game, right? Mm-hmm. Like, okay, it's an adventure game, but it's a simulation of a real adventure. Okay, so what I've been on real adventures and sort of like, you know, what does that mean, right? Well, you're usually going to some place, right? Like, oh, I'm going to go to, you know, this tourist attraction or that tourist attraction. Like, oh, I'm going to go to the pyramids in Chichen Itza in Mexico, right? And you're like, well, why, right? Yeah. Well, because I think they might be cool.
Right.
Because I'm going to like, I don't know. But but if everything goes according to plan, it's not an adventure, right?
Yeah.
Things have to go off the rails. And so, you know, so a lot of it is just inspired by like what, if you go on a real adventure, what does it feel like, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's very much what I was thinking of when I was making the game. And a lot of the rest of it, like the trials and a lot of it, a lot of people come from the story standpoint, but the story came after the gameplay. Like my game development methodology is like, it's a video game and the gameplay is the most important part. So.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely interesting. Yeah, because you mentioned that you had kind of one of your original ideas was the verbiage, using the verbs to do things and to type those out. Did you have the idea for the cell phone early on, to have the cell phone kind of as your kind of tool throughout the world?
I did. One of the things that I noticed, now that I've become addicted to my cell phone, is how annoying it is to play a video game.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually, like, it feels like there's something wrong when my, like, I don't have my cell phone. I walk around with my cell phone in real life.
Yeah.
But, like, check it way too much.
Yeah.
And, like, it seemed very strange to me to be playing, like, a first-person video game and my character never looks at their phone. I'm like, what's wrong with them, right? So that was one of the core inspirations there. It's, like, just sort of, like, I don't know. Part of it was for me, right? Like, I want to play this game and feel normal.
Yeah.
So I put this kind of surrogate phone in there so that I could feel normal. But obviously you need some kind of UI also. So.
Yeah. Well, no, it absolutely worked in that it did feel very, you know, it did feel normal to kind of have that phone there. And then, you know, it was nice that you could minimize it and kind of bring it down a little bit.
Yeah. And then you can look down at it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, once I found out how to do that, I was like, well, this is like real life. Like, especially like when it's minimized, you can look down at it and be like, oh, wow. Like, this is how I sometimes walk around. This is interesting. It was cool that you could change the different themes on the phone too. Was that another concept that was early on?
Yeah, I wanted to put more theme-related stuff in the game. I still might.
Yeah.
Like, there's some, I want to do a content update and kind of expand what the themes can do, because some of the themes give you special abilities.
Yeah.
So I want to do that for more of the themes. There's like one that conspicuously should have a special ability, but doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't get in time.
Yeah.
I wanted people to feel like it was them playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
So the premise is that it's 10,000 years in the future. And, and one of the ideas that I had is that you play as yourself when you're 10,000 years old, right? Like, it's you. It would be you sitting here right now listening to me talk.
Yeah.
But now you've lived 10,000 years and you're in the future. And so I wanted it to feel like your phone, right? Whatever that might be.
Yeah, right. Right. I noticed another thing with not only the art style, but with the areas in the game, was that there's a lot of, and we talked about this briefly before, there's a lot of kind of modern tech mixed with very ritualistic ancient artifacts and tombs. Was there a reason behind that? Does that just go along with the cyberpunk theme?
Yeah. So So I was trying to imagine this future, mm-hmm. like that, you know, the basically people like us have created, right? Like mm-hmm. people living now who, like, you know, they don't die. We, like, solve right. all our medical problems and all of mm-hmm. our political problems and all of our food and housing problems. And so what kind of world would we want to live in? And one of the ideas that I had was, like, well, we want it to be pretty familiar, right? Mm-hmm. So you have this kind of chunky retro technology, not because it's necessary, but because yeah. it makes people feel comfortable.
True.
And, but yeah, also the idea was sort of just that, you know, the whole Trials is mm-hmm. kind of like a theme park, right? So there yeah. is a sort of like Disney-esque quality to some of the areas.
Including a gift shop.
Yeah, exactly. yeah. So yeah, the gift shop is directly inspired by my trip to the Vatican also, where when you exit the tour, they take you directly to the gift shop.
No.
There's a yeah, for real. Gift yeah. shop in the Vatican?
Okay, there's a bathroom in case you need to use it and buy.
Yeah, and oh, also all of the stuff in the shop is blessed by the Pope.
Yes.
Oh, gosh. Of course.
So it's slightly more expensive than the stuff that you would buy anywhere else.
So I'm not super religious, but I have some very deeply religious Catholic friends and family. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the idea that this is how your religious experience would end up if yeah. you were one of them
yeah.
was kind of fascinating to me.
Yeah. No, for sure. For sure. And so, going off the art style of the game, you mentioned that you chose the art style because that was something that, I mean, it was kind of just your natural art style ability, or did you choose this style in particular?
Yeah, there was a couple of things going into that. One, sure. I wanted something I could do quickly.
Absolutely.
Ish, because, you know, I think that one of the things that a lot of people don't really consciously grasp the first time they play is that, unlike most of the games you play, almost everything you look at in Trackless is unique. Mm-hmm. Like I've worked as a level designer on a bunch of games, and yeah. typically what you do is you have a tile set of 3D objects and you replicate them all over the place.
Yeah.
So you're just looking at the same stuff mm-hmm. over and over again. It's the same stuff in a different configuration.
Yeah.
So one of the ideas for the art style wasn't just to make it easier because I'm lazy, but to make it easier so I can make everything in the game that you look at unique.
Right.
So yeah, that was one of the ideas. Another one of the ideas is that I wanted to produce all the art within Unity mostly, but just mm-hmm. Unity and Photoshop. Mm-hmm. So I don't use a 3D modeling editor,
yeah,
like Blender or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was very interested in this kind of production workflow. It's a little bit mm-hmm. esoteric, but like the tools in Unity sort of suggested that you could build stuff this way, and I wanted to yeah. see if you could.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can, actually. but I don't think anybody else has done a full game in this style yet. So that was exciting to me.
Yeah, for sure. That's one thing that we, I think Frank was mentioning, was that, you know, we haven't really seen it anywhere before in right. any other game. Like I had, you know, I mean, like here and there, I had seen it done, but never, as you said, in a full game. So it definitely gives it a very unique and interesting style that, you know, I like, especially, you know, and at first, like it seems like even with the people you come in contact with, or that you see, you know, my first thought is at the train station when you first, at the very beginning of the game, when you come off the train and there's a group of people that just stare at you. Like, you know, right. you go from one side yes. to the other and they turn and they look and you're like, okay. And it's only a two-sided thing. And even like the other characters, they're only like two-sided, but it works so well. because especially like you can bump into them, you know, and like you move and they, you know, and they kind of turn with you. And so, yeah, I mean, it definitely works well. And I shared a video, and Kevin was saying that, you know, it might be a little bit older, but a video of like a tutorial that you did showing how that you made this, how that you made these models.
Right. Yeah,
which I found really fascinating. You know, I come from an art standpoint myself, and so it's very cool to see that. And that's available on the for those of you listening, the 12 East Games site. I think it was in your in the media packet, I think.
Yeah, it could be
with the page. Oh no, yeah. No, I think it's on the main page. I don't know, but yeah, that was very interesting. Do you find it difficult to you know, as an artist, and thinking to juggle that programming developer side with your artistic side?
Yeah, it is. Kind of the more I get better at programming, the lazier I get. And it's funny because like a lot of stuff in programming can be like done with a shortcut.
Yeah.
Like there's some easy way to do it. And it's like, you can do that in art, right? But like, it's not really your art anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But for a long time, I've approached art as just something I enjoy to do.
Yeah.
And spending a ton of time wasn't really a problem. But coding is really weird in that, like, sort of the more you get done, the better it is.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas that's definitely not true of art. It's like, no, you can, if you do just a little bit perfectly, then it's perfect.
Yeah.
Right? You can get perfect results if you just do it perfectly.
Yeah.
You can have something that looks great and then you spend another hour on it and it looks terrible.
Yep.
And you're like, why did I do that?
Every time. The worst.
It's definitely given me a different perspective about how to approach my work. Oh, one other thing I wanted to say about the art that I thought was really important to me. So it's inspired by text adventures. And so the art is not really it's not the thing, right? This is not it's meant to be, the art is meant to be functional. And one of the things that's, I thought more functional about this art than a lot of other art is that everything in the game is only as detailed as it needs to be. So all the stuff you interact with is pretty detailed, but like the train station itself, like the background has really chunky, thick black lines because you're usually seeing it from far away, you know? And that way it kind of brings what you need to interact with into focus.
That's true.
So that was what I liked about the art.
Most of the apartments don't have doors.
Yeah, there's some stuff that could be more detailed.
As you always, you always see these things after the fact on projects or on stuff to work on. Does anyone have any
what did y'all think of the game? That's mostly what I'm interested in. Did you have fun? was the game actually fun, or was it a chore? Because that's like the core question in my mind.
I like word puzzles, so I enjoyed the verb.
Excellent. I think there's people out there who like word puzzles, and this is like their game. I'm like, hey, I made a game for people who love words.
We were also talking about how the world, the things that you encountered in the game, and I think that goes on with the art style and everything, kind of made you want to find out more about the world that you're experiencing, because it was all so very interesting, also very in-depth feeling. That there was a story behind things.
A lot of people were frustrated that there wasn't more story in the game. And I think if I had it to do it over again, I would have put more in. Mm-hmm. There is like definitely like a reasoning behind everything in the game.
Like
there is a game world in my mind that like there's a reason for all of this stuff. But as a player, I feel like sometimes that stuff is put a little bit too much in the foreground. Sure. And so like, oh, here's a wall of text telling you about why you should care about this game world, but yeah. I don't care about your wall of text. I want to care first.
Right.
And then I'll read all the text.
Right.
So, yeah. So like, I didn't want to oversell the game world. Yeah. I wanted to just let it sort of like build and you learn about it.
Right.
So yeah, that was the philosophy there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also multiple endings, so it depends on how you feel about how the game ends.
Yeah.
Or whether the story was complete or incomplete.
Yes. I experienced one game ending that I thought I thought was the best was, but then I found out that it was, that there was a more detailed ending. I ended with the helicopter taking me back. And I was like, oh, well, this must be like the good ending, right? But then like I come into the chat this evening and everyone else is like, oh no, there's this whole other area that we completely missed. And I was like, oh, well, shoot.
Okay, so that's the first, like this is a sort of flips game logic upside down. The mm-hmm. first easiest ending is kind of the what I think of as like sort of the primary ending.
Yeah.
So the ending you got is like, I made that was the first one that I had the idea for.
Yeah.
Oh, you just go on the trip, you do the thing, yeah. and then yeah. you go home.
You're done.
Just yeah. like in real life, right?
Yeah, yeah, but you then, go to the gift shop, you're done.
Yeah, yeah. But then, you know, sort of as I thought about it, I was like, yeah, you know, I had the idea for the second ending pretty close after that. Mm-hmm. And the third ending, which almost nobody ever gets,
yeah.
is sort of like a stopgap for this weird case that a player could get into.
Yeah.
Like so one of the things that I think I should talk about with the game is mm-hmm. is like how sloppy it is, right? Like I think if you play the game, you know, and you start going through and you start like noticing the point system or mm-hmm. whatever, like people who are really concerned about competitive gaming and mm-hmm. getting the highest score
yeah.
often find that the point scoring is pretty capricious. And it's like, mm-hmm. yeah, like I could have put a lot more effort into fine tuning that so it felt more fair, but you know, and it's like, well, you can jump out of the levels, you know,
yeah.
you try, yeah. and you yeah. run at the edge of the levels and you jump and jump, 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 you can get out of the level. And then there's a lot of other things where if you stand just at the right angle, it's like, well, you know, the illusion of the arc breaks down, right? Like the whole game, it yeah. becomes yeah. obvious that the whole game is in fact not the game. But one of the things that was yeah. important to me is in this whole process of you doing all those things, it's still, I still don't feel like it really breaks the illusion.
Yeah, right.
Because the game is so abstract to start mm-hmm. with.
Yeah, yeah,
and true. Yeah, the game never pretends it's not a game. But mm-hmm. there were things that I was not sloppy about. And one of them was like the save system. I tried to make it actually functional.
That was nice, yeah.
And like seamless. And then there was like, you know, the game logic in the game is really complicated, actually. There's like tons of scripting. And I sure, tested yeah. that stuff, you know, not just me, but, you know, people I got help from. We tested yeah. all of the scripting for all of the puzzles.
Yeah.
Dozens of times, all of the collision for mm-hmm. everything that
mm-hmm.
that a normal player might run into a lot. And I felt mm-hmm. like, yeah, I've gotten very few bug reports. There's
yeah.
one bug that I know of that affects a tiny portion of the players, unfortunately, that I haven't fixed or tracked down. But that's it. The rest of it is, it's just ways that the player can break the game if they want to break the game. And I honestly think players should be able to do that if they want to, right? Yeah. Like the game isn't designed to like stop you from having fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
No, yeah.
So that's
the
third ending clue.
Yeah, the third ending. Did anybody get
that? Besides Kevin, aside from me.
A little bit about
yeah,
it.
Aside from Kevin.
Yeah. Yeah, the rest of us, yeah, most everyone got the more detailed ending with the space shuttle.
The rocket, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting for the player who gets the third ending on the first try. It's called the True Seeker. ending. Oh. And I think I still think that somebody will come along and they'll be like, no, screw this, screw that. I want to get it. And they'll get that ending. Sooner or later it'll happen.
So that would be like what happened, like I had the sour and the sweet seeker in mind. So that would be like if they were players, then they would get the true seeker ending.
Oh yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Simply because they're a little bit not on the bright side and got lost.
Poor sweet and sour. They're just there living their lives.
Yeah, sour seeker is like my favorite. Like side seeker character.
Yeah, you know, like, so one of the things that happened during the course of playtesting is that people mm-hmm. kept coming back and saying, we want more story. You know, like,
yeah.
like this is cool. We like the game world. Where's the story? So originally, like, I did have that idea for the second ending, the rocket ship ending. I was like, okay, I'm going to put it in, like the secret mm-hmm. ending.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'm working on the game, and it's grueling. It's really grueling to make video games, especially when you try to do everything yourself,
yeah.
which is a mistake, probably. so I'm like, you know, approaching one of the first deadlines, and I'm like, oh, I know, we'll just cut it. We'll cut it. We'll cut that ending. We don't need it. It's not necessary. And so... okay, I cut it. I built the game out with just the first ending.
Yeah.
And send it out to the very first playtesters.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, that's cool, but we want more story. What happens to all of the other stuff? How does it all resolve? And I'm like, you know, I actually have an answer for that, but I cut it. So then we pushed the release date back, and I added it back in. All of that stuff that I had originally planned. And then, you know, people played that and they're like, well, that's pretty good, but why isn't there more story? so I added all the side characters, all the other
there's always someone that's gonna want something else.
Yeah, well, I don't think they were wrong,
right
and like that did add a lot, and I think probably the game could have had, I don't know, twice as much story. That would have been better for it, but I just didn't know.
It definitely has the depth for it. It definitely has the, just the setting and everything, and the story that, you know, the story that you do get makes you, I think that's saying something for your storytelling, is that people want to know more about it. You know, they could just play it and not care. You know, yeah. but they want, they're just like, but I want to know more about this world. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely saying something that's definitely in your credit for sure.
I think saying that it would make a good book or something.
So. Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. No, I do. I think the setting is definitely, of course, I'm not a huge, like, I know it's kind of based off of cyberpunk. I'm not a huge, like, I haven't delved a lot into that into that world, but what I found, I mean, especially even like talking it over with people and talking it over with everyone this evening, it brought me to like a better kind of appreciation, I guess. And yeah, for sure, I think it's definitely a fascinating story attached to the game.
Yeah, so I've read a bunch of cyberpunk stuff, mm-hmm. and I was a fan, you know. But like one of the things that's interesting, probably the most famous cyberpunk author, William Gibson, he stopped writing cyberpunk. Mm-hmm. And the reason he stopped is because all the things that he wrote about as super cool and futuristic in the 80s actually came true. And so he didn't have anything left to write about. So now he just writes about books. Well, I guess his last book was set in the near future. But mm-hmm. like his,
yeah.
he wrote three books that are basically set in the present day.
Oh, and, my goodness.
And they're pretty good. I would just skip most of the cyberpunk and read those three books from William Gibson. Because they're about like designer jeans and YouTube and like, yeah. It's
kind of cool. Interesting.
So yeah, that was another like kind of focus for, I'm sure, like, one of the things that really puts a lot of gamers off when they look at Trackless is like, oh, this game isn't for me because it's like there's no shooting. But also, like, I think that they don't really respond to the way the world looks or any of the characters because it's like they don't look super tough or badass. Like, and really, like, almost all the characters are very, like I spent months just researching clothes for, like, the characters, right? Yeah. Like, their clothes to look like they're kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, chic. Like, yeah, like, actually.
Fashionable.
Yeah, fashionable. Like, clothes people might actually wear instead of clothes video game people would wear.
But yeah.
Especially if you have, like, unlimited amount of time, you're like, I want to look exactly in this way, and I have the technology to do it.
Yeah.
How would you dress, you know?
Yeah.
And it has a very neo, like a neo Tokyo vibe.
Yeah.
Oh, it does. Mm-hmm. It does. Yeah, it has kind of see like an Asian influence in them.
Yeah, I looked at an awful lot of like Harajuku fashion.
Nice.
And, you know, runway fashion, all sorts of stuff. So, like, you tell that to, like, normal gamer dudes, and they're like, oh, they're like, that makes me feel threatened or something. I don't know. I don't get it. But, yeah, it's definitely impacted my sales. So thanks.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, and we were talking about, like, you know, at first I kind of would have been in that boat of like, I, you know, I would want... Like, oh, I wish there was more story, more explanation behind these things. But then Kevin brought up while we were chatting was that, you know, he kind of liked that kind of coming to your own conclusion of things. Kevin, is that how you were?
Yeah. You have to, you just think about the different stuff and you can kind of form some conclusions on your own from what you're given and other stuff. You're just kind of like, maybe it's that way. I don't know.
Not everything has to be written out and explained, and you know,
it's sort of frustrating to not have it explained, and then you have to be like, what's the backup when the game doesn't explain to you exactly how you're supposed to feel or what it means? Then you have to resort to actually thinking about what it actually feels
about it yourself,
right? Like, how do I feel about this, right?
It makes some people uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's not about what your character in the game is supposed to feel, because you're playing yourself in the game.
Right.
It's about what you're actually feeling. So I don't know if any of that comes through. I like, obviously, as I mentioned, I've been making video games for a long time and been playing video games for way, way longer.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I've played, I don't know, tens of thousands, over to 10,000 hours of video games, I'm confident, right? Mm-hmm. Like, in my lifetime, I was homeschooled, so while everybody else was in school, I was playing video games.
Yeah.
So I played a lot.
So tell me this, so what's your favorite? Do you have a favorite?
My favorite video game?
Or one of your top five?
Probably Super Mario 64. It's definitely up there.
Oh, really?
I really like it.
Awesome. Were you a Super Mario Brothers fan before that? Like, did you play like the Super NES and
NES. I played Super Mario Brothers in the arcade, actually.
Oh. Wow. I played it at home on the Nintendo, but I didn't get the arcade experience.
Yeah, the original one was on arcade before it came out on the NES.
Man.
So yeah, I played it way back. And yeah, you know, I like those games. But the reason that I like Super Mario 64 is because the analog stick on the Nintendo 64 is really, really sensitive before it breaks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that particular hardware with that controller, like, it wears out really quickly. But for that first, like, 6 months that you have it, it's, like, really better than anything else that came before or since. So, and the game was designed around that controller. And I feel like there's something really, really precise and sublime about that combination.
It's a good experience for you.
So, yeah. you know, when we're talking about like, oh, well, what do I like, you know, and yeah. that's definitely up there.
Yeah.
But I like a lot of different kinds of games. Probably the one that I like that's the most recent is Forza Horizon. It's like a racing game.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, I haven't played it yet, but I know.
You can drive around. You drive around it over and over again.
Yeah.
But it does driving around in circles very well. You can also drive from point A to point B. It does that very well too.
Wow, that's
amazing. Yes, perfect simulation.
Yeah. I think. So if you know that I love Forza Horizon, you can definitely see that influence in Trackless. Because like Forza Horizon is this weird kind of Burning Man meets extreme racing festival. Mm. It's like the world setting. It's weird for a racing game to even have like a world, but it totally does.
Interesting.
So yeah. I like that game a lot.
Very cool. Does anyone else have any questions for Aubrey? Anything that we didn't cover?
Is the way with Leander is it because he just kind of wants to be your buddy?
So Leander is a really interesting. It's really interesting because most players, most guys especially, hate him. They really hate Leander.
Yeah. My initial reaction was he's annoying.
Yeah, and most of the women who've played like him a lot, and I think it's really an interesting reaction, and I sort of set him up that way because you know, when you do the. When you register the first time, the first character you notice is Hyro. And you ask her, and she's like, you know, you kind of approach her maybe thinking that she's going to partner up with you. And, you know, she's not interested. Mm-hmm. And so, like, obviously the player might be disappointed, right? Like, oh, this thing that I was planning didn't work out.
So
I didn't set him up for success, but I think that the negative reaction is really interesting because Leander is sort of like the character that I think makes the most sense in the game. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have any problems. He has nothing to do. He's just trying to enjoy himself.
Yeah.
And, you know, to that extent, he's just sort of like going with the flow. You know, that's what he does. And to me, that makes sense. And that's why I like him. But yeah, it's interesting because I think most players turn around, especially if you play the extended ending, you get way more Leander. And he's sort of like, you know, obviously when he helps you out to get the airlifter, you know, you're breaking in with him. You're like conspirators. That's kind of the feeling. That's supposed to be when he's like, oh, this guy that I thought was sort of, you know, wasn't going to help me out is actually like pretty useful. But yeah, in the final stretch of the game, I think people turn around on how they feel about him, which I'm happy about. I like him as a character.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I think he does want to be like your buddy eventually, just, you know.
See, I didn't get that we were supposed to partner up until I talked to Leander, and he's like, "What do you do after you register?"
Oh yeah.
I was just trying to figure out how to tell him, like, "Get your pet to the lady over there."
Yeah,
that's what I did.
The station is the worst part. I wish. From a gameplay perspective, from a narrative perspective, I think the station makes a lot of sense. But from a gameplay perspective, for a new player, it's definitely the worst part.
I think, and this is a little meta, but like that gameplay reflects how confusing it is at stations where people are getting on and getting off of trains and stuff.
Yeah.
But I got the space ending. We go in the rocket, and I felt like with that, with the other interactions with Leander, that he was on this journey, like also has like self-discovery, because he gets in there. He's like, oh, I found this boat. I'm just going to kind of hang out in this boat. Because this is the part that I'm enjoying.
Yeah.
And to me, that seemed to be like that he got the point of whatever this religious pilgrimage was, to go and see the object. Like, whatever you think you're getting, like, he was already focused on it.
Yeah.
And so he was just like, I'm going to progress because I'm already like halfway there. But like, he's already. And even when you talk to him out in the desert, he's like, I'm going to stay out here with the equipment for a little bit if that's okay. And dude, you do you.
Exactly. And I don't know, I guess some people don't like that aspect of them. It's like, no, you're supposed to be my, like, especially in video game terms, it's like, no, you're supposed to be subordinate to me. Mm-hmm. I'm the player.
Yeah.
Every other character needs to march to my beat, right? Yeah. Like, you joined my party. Like, if this is an RPG, it's like, now I should be able to, like, dress you and tell you what your job is.
True, right?
Or, like, it's an escort mission, and you're like, do I need to go back to the other side and get him now? Like, once you go across the bridge.
And he just takes care of himself, and then he does his own thing, and so does all the other characters.
Yeah.
So, there's a lot of that kind of stuff where it confounds sort of, like, standard video game logic. But there was the other aspect of the game is that it's, like, I definitely wanted to bring every single person along with the ride. The game is not designed to be especially difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the game is just supposed, the game, I tried to design the game for everyone, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I wanted literally anybody to sit down and so.
Yeah. Yeah. That's funny you said that, Madeline. That was kind of one of my thoughts whenever he was out in the boat in the water. I'm just kind of sailing around and being like, hey, I'm using the boat. And I was like, oh, am I going to have to go and rescue him from this boat now?
Like, what? Is the ferry, are we going to have to go and pick him up in the ferry? Do I have to hack this again?
Or honestly, like, I was waiting for something bad to happen. Like, I was like, I was watching him from the boat and I was like, oh no, something's going to happen to Leander. Oh no. Oh no. But no, he was fine. He was fine.
He comes and helps you out.
And Hyrule, you're just like doing all this stuff, and you're like, oh, I had to take this air tram all the way across, and Hyrule's like there in like 2 seconds. Like, where did you come from?
Yeah,
on top of it.
Batman. Yeah. My model for Hyrule is she's like Batman, basically. She's just like shows up. She's on top of stuff. Like tracking people down.
Hyrule like swam through the dam and like climbed up the wall.
I think so.
She probably did something that was way easier, that, you know, got some other, you know, asked one of her buddies to like help her out, drop her off.
For sure. Looking on 12 East Games page, you guys are working on Monster Training Academy next.
Yeah.
Which looks exciting. I love the artwork for it. And I had just looked at it this evening, and it looks charming. It looks wonderful. Could you tell us anything about that? About
sure. We've been kind of working on a prototype, a coder, Brian Cronin, mm-hmm. who's way into card games. And so he's actually just has like a Kickstarter for his card game, one last job right now. And so the idea is sort of like kind of refine kind of, you know, a JRPG format into like, well, like, the pitch is it's Pokemon plus Harry Potter, right? But, I'm a big fan of the Harry Potter books, but I feel like once they get away from, like, the school year and the school stuff after Goblet of Fire, the series kind of, like, just goes off the rails, right? Yeah. Like, it changes and becomes a different thing. And I kind of just like the wizard school stuff and the school year.
Yeah.
And so... So part of the game is going to be like basically a college simulator. I think. Like, there's a certain sense of you have all these especially Western RPGs, but some JRPGs mm-hmm. where you're making like skill tree choices, right?
Yeah.
Like it's very similar to like choosing your major, picking your classes mm-hmm. At a college. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the core insight there, is that like the real life colleges already have a whole system for like how to drop classes if you don't like them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you would take a class, and in Monster Training Academy, it'll give you a skill. But if you don't like that skill, you can drop it before the drop date, right?
Oh my goodness, yeah.
So there's going to be like, that sounds kind of like boring, I think.
No, that's fantastic. Theory. You can test it. You can test skill before and then decide like, no, this isn't the direction I want to go, and then drop it.
Yeah, and then pick a different class. But you run out of time, so you eventually have to pick some class.
Mm-hmm.
And then, nice. So yeah, the game is kind of going to be structured around a school year, I think probably 4 years, and sort of like, and then kind of broken down into smaller chunks of time, semesters. Yeah. And weeks, and then in a given like day or a week, you have certain assignments that you're trying to accomplish, and then you do that by like assembling a team of monsters, and like, you know, equipping them and raising them, and then going into different dungeons to try to do all your class assignments, get all your accomplishments done, and with the goal of the game is to graduate with the highest GPA you can. And so, yeah, that's sort of the idea. I think it's probably a very different take on most people's idea of what this kind of game might be. And I'm going to try to put enough story in this time, right? Like, you know, there's going to be a main character. There's going to be side characters. There's going to be all this stuff. But that's the core gameplay. Like I was saying, my design mentality starts with the gameplay. The gameplay is to... Yeah. And I think it's sort of subversive to mm-hmm. teach, like, for people who haven't been to college, it's educational to teach them sort of how college works and how to spend your time and you know, how you can sort of neglect some classes so you can focus on other ones and all these mm-hmm. skills that people learn in college. But for people who are out of college, it's sort of fun to use all those old skills again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, have a chance to be like, ah, I know how to do this. You know?
Kind of like, stretching out that muscle that you haven't used in.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like final semester in college, I took, what was it, 20 credit hours?
Huh.
That was a lot. It was really, really a lot. And I had to skip just certain days. Certain classes on certain days, I had to skip them because I knew that it wouldn't impact my grade very much.
Yeah, for sure.
And so that's sort of the experience that is inspiring that particular game dynamic.
That's exciting. I totally wouldn't, I mean, because I'm looking at the pictures and stuff that you posted so far, and I totally wouldn't have picked that up. So
nobody does. But I think it will be fun nonetheless, you know?
Yeah. No, for sure. That's a very interesting mechanic. I really like. Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited. Do you have a scheduled release date for this, or just whenever you can get it
done?
Not
yet. We have done a couple of prototypes, but the last prototype, the coder wasn't happy with how people reacted to the gameplay. And we're going to add some more meat to the core gameplay loop. Before, the idea was sort of, you have this really immense metagame where you're picking these classes, and then you're also hatching monsters, and you're raising monsters, and you're skilling up your monsters, and you're equipping your monsters, and you're equipping yourself. And then all this metagame kind of focused down onto really simple moment-to-moment decisions of whether you're just going to try to fight the monsters in the next room or whether you're going to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the most simple decision you can make in a game. Like, 21, you know, you're familiar with gambling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not very familiar with gambling, but I played 21. Basically, you have this choice of like whether you want them to give you another card or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the decision is like, well, do I think the card is gonna be, you know, keep me under the limit, right? Like,
right.
And so that was originally that was the core idea, is this kind of like, you know, go bust, go forward or go bust mechanic, yeah. right? Like you're trying to estimate how risky the next room is and what state your monsters are in and if you can clear it. But yeah, there's a lot of really fundamental problems with that. And then, so the second leg of my design philosophy is to test
sure.
everything with real players.
Sure.
So,
and that's smart. You know, yeah.
Yeah. We're going to retool it so that, so choosing to go forward is still going to be a big deal, but it's going to seem cooler. You're going to have multiple choices of like, what is the next room I want to go into?
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to have choices of which monster's skill you want to deploy in any individual encounter.
Mm-hmm.
But all that stuff is designed to be fast and easy. My main problem with JRPGs is that the combat can get really tedious. You spend a lot of time just hammering the button and waiting for animations to play.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you grind through multiple encounters with enemies that can't realistically kill you.
Right.
So, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of, that's the problem I want to fix.
Yay.
So, yeah.
I look forward to it.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. I just subscribed to your mailing list. So if you guys
Did it give you, okay, this is an important question. There's there's these new European regulations coming online soon, and we just changed the mailing list.
Okay.
Did it give you like a second option, like to opt in, like a special thing to like
a are double
you
really opt-in.
Sure you want to do this?
I think so.
Yeah, probably. It's pretty like streamlined still. But yeah.
I mean, it was very intuitive. So whatever it was popped up, I was like, yes, okay, let's do this.
Before you would just put your thing in and be like, oh, you've been added.
Okay. Yeah. No. Yeah. It sent an email first, and then through the email link, it took me to another window saying that I can manage my preferences, blah, blah, blah. And then.
Okay, cool. Yeah. That's all the news.
Yeah. So it worked.
Super scary for all us game developers.
Oh no.
All the stuff in Europe is changing, and now we're all like in danger of getting sued, and it's terrifying.
Thanks, Facebook.
Oh my goodness. Well, we enjoyed the game, in Trackless. Excited to see what you guys do with Monster Training Academy. And again, thank you, Aubrey, for being on here. Your lovely wife as well.
Angelica.
Yes, Angelica. Yes, sorry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But again, we really appreciate you stopping in and chatting about the game with us. And we have this, and we're going to have it up on our site for other people to listen to as well. So to get the word out there about you guys, 12 East Games.
Awesome.
All right. Well,
thanks again.
Thank you. Sign off from there. Thanks, everyone, for joining. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.